From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, luck and hard luck. First, glamour, debauchery, and high-stakes gambling in Havana, and how mobsters like Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano raked in vast profits from hotels, casinos, and nightclubs before Castro's revolution shut them down. We talk with T.J. English, author of Havana Nocturne, which comes out in paperback next week. Also, a woman, her dog, and hard times on the road. We talk with Kelly Reichert about her film Wendy and Lucy, which is now out on DVD. It stars Michelle Williams as a loner on her way to find work in Alaska. While making the film, they met some people who were truly down on their luck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. As President Obama gently moves the U.S. toward a closer relationship to Cuba, and the island awaits the passing of the Castro regime, you can get a vivid picture of a very different time in the Caribbean nation from our guest, T.J. English. He's the author of Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba, Then Lost It to the Revolution. The book recalls the Cuba of the 1950s, when a military dictatorship opened the nation to the American mob, which saw the island as a safe haven for gambling and prostitution. English describes a Havana teeming with American tourists, staying in swank, mob-owned hotels, gambling at casinos, dancing the mambo at nightclubs, and indulging their fantasies at live sex shows and bordellos. Castro's guerrilla movement also lent an air of exotic danger to tourism in Havana. But English believes American hedonism and other forms of exploitation of Cuba provoked anti-American anger on the island, which strengthened the revolution and eventually led to the downfall of the Batista regime. T.J. English has written three previous books and numerous magazine pieces, as well as episodes of NYPD Blue and Homicide. I spoke to him last summer when Havana Nocturne was first published. It comes out in paperback next week. Well, T.J. English, welcome back to Fresh Air. This book that you've written deals with a period in the 50s mostly when the American mob had its way in Havana. And I thought we would begin by listening to a clip from the movie The Godfather 2, which focuses on this period. And this is a scene in which the main Jewish mobster in the film, Hyman Roth, who is based on the real historical character of Meyer Lansky, is having a birthday party on a balcony in Havana, and he's meeting with a whole other American mobsters who are there and talking about their plans for the future. Let's listen.
These are wonderful things that we've achieved in Havana, and there's no limit to where we can go from here. This kind of government knows how to help business, to encourage it. The hotels here are bigger and swankier than any of the rough joints we put in Vegas. And we can thank our friends in the Cuban government, which has put up half of the cash with the Teamsters on a dollar-for-dollar basis, has relaxed restrictions on imports. What I'm saying is that we have now what we have always needed, real partnership with the government.
And that's Lee Strasberg playing Hyman Roth, the Meyer Lansky character in the film Godfather 2. T.J. English, this meeting of mobsters in Havana is actually predicated on a real event, right?
Yes, it is. That incident took place at the Hotel Nacional in Havana in 1946. It was a gathering of the brain trust of the mob in the United States at that time. All of them to meet in Havana to discuss the exploitation of Cuba, establishing Cuba as a kind of criminal base, which had been the dream of the American mob going all the way back to the 1920s.
Now, this plan to, in effect, sort of adopt Cuba as a safe haven for mob activity is, you know, took many, many years to get going. But a critical moment was in 1952 when Batista was, in effect, running Cuba at the time. And he brought Meyer Lansky back. And it's interesting that they quickly formed this close partnership. And the hotel and casino and nightclub scene in Havana flourished, and the mob began making a fortune. Tell us just a little bit about the financial relationships that made this possible. To what extent was the mob really running Cuba? And to what extent was the government of Cuba helping to finance the mob's operations?
Right. Well, there was a development institution known as Banco de Desarrollo Económico y Social, Bandes. It was a development institution controlled by the government that financed the building of bridges and highways and everything else on the island. There were also a couple of banks, Banco Atlantico y Banco de Créditos y Inversiones. These were banks that were controlled by the mob in Cuba, so that this tourism boom that was also part of this development of the criminal empire was all financed by mob money. So you would have the overflow of money from the casinos, which was phenomenal, that would flow into the nightclubs and also flow into the financial institutions like banks and development agencies, so that the very development of the country was being financed by the mob, by the criminal activity. And this is really kind of unprecedented. And they attracted a flood of tourists, mostly from North America and from Europe, who came to Havana seeing it as one of the great entertainment scenes throughout history, in a way, because it really was a confluence of a kind of entertainment and sort of slightly dangerous feel to it, particularly as the revolution began to unfold. And we can certainly talk a bit about that. And so really what you had is this great entertainment era of dance and music and gambling and sex.
One of the slogans that Vegas uses today is what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And we live in an era where there's so much, you know, where sex and all kinds of hedonism is so much more a part of the culture than it was in the 1950s. Did airlines and travel agents and others talk about Havana as a place you could really go and just let it all out?
Oh, boy, did they ever. I mean, they really, see, this is part of what led to the revolution. There became this relationship between the criminal elements who were promoting Havana for their own reasons and large American corporations like Pan Am and the Hilton Hotel chain who were promoting Havana for their reasons. And so you started to see an intersection between the legitimate American corporate business entities and also the underworld entities. And so Havana was heavily promoted. You know, Havana had sort of existed in the consciousness of Americans for quite some time, probably beginning in the 1920s through the music and through Hollywood movies. And it had been promoted as kind of an exotic tourist destination that was, you know, just 90 miles off the coast of the state of Florida. And it's just there was so much money around that the nightclubs were able to hire these huge orchestras, and they probably wouldn't have been able to if it had not been for the money that was generated by the casinos. And so you had orchestras like Perez Prado, who began the mambo craze, and all of this was really quite an extraordinary period in time for those who passed through it.
You know, sex and the sale of sex is always part of an escapist tourism scene. And there's a memorable scene in The Godfather, too, where the gang goes to a really, well, exotic sex club and sees a guy with a really exotic sex act. How kinky was the scene in Havana back then?
Well, that scene in The Godfather where they go to the theater, that is based on an actual theater, the Shanghai Theater, which was located in Havana's Chinatown. And it was an old Chinese theater that had been converted into a kind of live sex emporium that was pretty kinky. I think about as kinky as you can get, although it also had a theatrical nature to it. You know, this just wasn't a strip club. It was a club where you would go where they would actually do kind of comical skits, often little theater pieces that were bawdy and usually ended with outright nudity, if not actual live sex acts being performed on the stage. I mean, a lot of the tourists that passed to Havana in the 1950s wanted to go to the Shanghai because it was notorious at the time. There was a performer there who went by the name of Superman, who was famous for the size of his appendage. And that's also portrayed in the movie The Godfather 2. And so stemming from that, you just had a lot of sex going on in Havana, ranging from just kind of tourists on the loose in an exotic foreign land, sexual tourism. But you also had prostitution, and you had sex performances. Along with the Shanghai Theater, they had private shows. You could go to a home in a kind of nice, discreet neighborhood in the city, and there in that home would be a kind of sex parlor, which you could view and perhaps even take part in. And so it was kind of a multi-leveled sexual marketplace that contributed to what was viewed as the allure of this whole entertainment era.
Tell us about American celebrities going to Havana. Sinatra, I mean, he was known for having friends in the mob. John F. Kennedy made it down there. Tell us about some of the, you know, better known excursions by American celebrities to Havana.
Right. Well, that was also part of what would become the reputation of Havana in the 50s was that it became this scene and that drew a lot of celebrities there. And so you would got celebrities like Marlon Brando, who came to Havana in the 1950s. He was drawn by the music and the women. Brando was a conga player, a bongo player, percussionist, amateur percussionist, and was down there to buy a drum, a conga drum, and also to take part in the music and the dancing. Errol Flynn, the actor Errol Flynn, was quite prominent there in the 1950s. Of course, Hemingway had been coming to Cuba since the 1930s and actually lived there in the 1950s, and so he was kind of a local mascot during this period of the 1950s. The casinos often hired celebrities. Capri Hotel hired the actor George Raft, who was kind of near the end of his career by that time, but he was famous for portraying mobsters and gangsters throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s in many, many movies. And they hired him as kind of meter and greeter at the casino at the Capri. He became another kind of mascot of the era. Yeah, that was a big part of it, the draw of the celebrities, partly the underworld allure, the connections to gangsters. That was certainly the case with Sinatra, who had many mobster friends. And keep in mind, gambling was legal in Havana, and so you could go to the casinos and hang out with known mobsters, and since you were outside the United States, it really wasn't going to cause you any problems with the law.
Our guest is T.J. English. His newest book is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is writer T.J. English. He's written a book about mobsters in Cuba in the 1950s. It's called Havana Nocturne. While the mob is having its fun in Havana and making a fortune and tourists are streaming in and this hedonistic nightclub culture flourishes, a guerrilla movement grows in the eastern part of the island led by Fidel Castro, the son of a landlord who was a student and intellectual. And we don't really have time, I guess, to describe how the revolution develops. You describe it really one big improvisation, a whole series of disasters that that befall it. But eventually it takes hold and begins to get more support and become a real threatening force in the late 50s. To what extent did the mob scene and the nightclub and casino scene in Havana fuel the revolution? To what extent was resentment at that form of American exploitation, if we want to call it that, force for the revolution?
Yes, I think this is, this is the most important point of the book, because here were these events, this exploitation of Havana and the revolution, sort of, they were unfolding at the same time. So, of course, they had to have had some sort of relationship. And I think what it was is the exploitation of Havana, the plundering of Havana economically and turning it into a kind of a bordello, was a symbol to the revolution of the capitalist exploitation that was taking place through the Batista regime. The Castro and the revolution saw the mob and the capitalists who were operating in Havana kind of as all one entity. And so what was taking place in Havana really became a symbolic motivation for the revolution, a driving motivation for the revolution in a way.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, the fact that the rebels were making some progress and there were acts of sabotage made the Havana scene all seem that much more dangerous. This, of course, comes to a climax on New Year's Eve 1958, December 31st, 1958. And it was known that the rebels had made progress and were getting closer to Havana. Did the fact that there was some sense that and Batista was seen as perhaps being increasingly isolated and on his last legs, did any of that prevent the nightclubs from holding big New Year's Eve celebrations? Did they have any sense that of how close the revolution was to taking over?
No, I think it just added to the excitement of the nightlife scene in Cuba at the time. See, the revolution was unfolding on the island mostly outside of Havana, and Havana was kind of this little dream world where all this kind of money was flowing and people were dancing and drinking and fornicating into the tropical night. And so they didn't really pay much attention to what was happening around the rest of the island. And since Batista controlled the media on the island, there was propaganda that led people to believe that Batista had things under control and everything was okay. There were intimations of it because, like you say, there was occasional acts of sabotage, bombs that would go off in the city of Havana, even in the Tropicana nightclub. A bomb was set off. But this only added to the excitement in a way. And so you kind of have a frenzy, a peaking as the revolution, as rumor of the revolution grows and grows. The excitement of the nightlife scene in Havana at the time only became more heated and exciting.
So New Year's Eve, people are partying the night away. And then somewhere in the middle of the night, Batista quietly resigns and leaves the island with zillions of dollars.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is you describe how Meyer Lansky, I mean, the American mobster, who is in many respects the architect of all of this, learns of the events. Tell us about what he heard and what he did.
Yeah, well, I had a great source on this. I had a number of good sources on this, but the best source, I dedicated the book to a man by the name of Armando Jaime Casillas, who was Lansky's driver and bodyguard and valet during the last 2 years of this period, 57, 58 on into 59. And he had become quite close to Lansky and was with Lansky that night. And Lansky, he caught wind of it. The revolution at that time was coming very close to Cuba. They were in the city of Las Villas. Che Guevara led a column of soldiers that had taken the city of Las Villas. So everyone knew that the revolution was approaching, and Lansky actually got word that the city of Las Villas had fell and that Batista had fled the country. Batista had loaded up a lot of cash, and without telling the mobsters or anyone else, he'd got on an airplane and left the country right after midnight on January 1st, 1959. And so Lansky is given this information discreetly before anyone else really knows it when he's at this restaurant. And he immediately kicks into action. And his first concern, of course, and it makes perfect sense, is get the money. He tells Armando Jaime Casillas, we've got to make the rounds to all the casinos. We've got to make sure that the counting rooms are secure, that the money is secure. You know, the island is going to fall. It could get violent. It could get heated. And we have to protect our assets. So there was a frenzied night and into the early morning of Lansky and his driver bodyguard driving around to the different casino hotels and trying to make sure that the cash was secured so that if they needed to get it off the island, they would at least have it all gathered and ready to go.
Now, Lansky gets word before the populace does, but as he's proceeding through trying to secure these enormous amounts of cash that the casinos have generated, word begins to leak out of Batista's departure. How did the citizens of Havana react?
Well, it took a while because no one quite believed it when they first started to hear it, and the word spread through the streets of Havana, and people were kind of stunned by it. It wasn't the kind of thing that would make its way into the media because the government controlled the media, and so it was just wild rumor for a while. But as time went on and people got a sense of what was happening, they started to gather in the streets. It became a kind of a combination celebration and riot all rolled into one. And one of the most telling things about it was by the early morning, as huge mobs of people started to flow through the streets of Havana making music and cheering revolutionary slogans, one of the first things they did was target the casinos. They went into a number of the casinos and trashed the casinos and dragged gambling equipment out into the streets and set it on fire. So this was a really clear example of the degree to which the casinos and the gambling and the whole presence of the mob in Havana had become a source of resentment, anger, and even revolutionary fervor that eventually boiled over on the morning of January 1st, 1959.
And the actor George Raft was doing his usual business, greeting people at, was it the Capri Casino?
Yes, it was.
And what happened?
The people and the Revolutionary Guard stormed into the casino at the time when he was there. He was determined to save the place. And so he tells the story. There are other eyewitness accounts of this story. His version of it from his biography is, of course, the most flattering to him, of how he stood up to the revolutionaries. And one of the lead revolutionaries who was there to trash the casino looked at him and said to the others, she said, "That's George Raft, the actor." So they all kind of stopped, a recognizable face. And he said to them, "Look, you know, take what you want, but there's no need to trash the casinos." And so the legend is that he kind of talked them down and saved the Capri Hotel Casino from being trashed.
T.J. English recorded last year. He'll be back in the second half of the show. His book, Havana Nocturne, comes out in paperback next week. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, a website designed to help teachers and the public explore the pros and cons of controversial issues. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what the mob did when Castro's revolution shut their party down in Havana. More with T.J. English, author of Havana Nocturne. And director Kelly Reichardt on her film Wendy and Lucy, described as the best art house girl and dog story you're ever going to see. It's now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is T.J. English. His book, Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba, Then Lost It to the Revolution, comes out in paperback next week. It describes the Cuba of the 1950s, when American mobsters ran hotels, nightclubs, and casinos in Havana, while Fidel Castro's guerrillas were gaining support in the countryside. When we left off, English was describing New Year's Eve 1958, when the island's dictator, Fulgencio Batista, had fled the country, and the legendary mobster Meyer Lansky went around Havana trying to secure cash from hotels and casinos. If you look at a position of someone like Lansky, I mean, there was a Back then, it wasn't so clear exactly what kind of government Fidel Castro would set up. And if you're Meyer Lansky, you've put, I guess, tens or hundreds of millions in investment into this place. It's making a fortune. And you figure that this new government is not going to want to give up all that cash, all that foreign exchange. So you might be able to deal with them. On the other hand, they might shoot you. What did Lansky decide to do?
Yeah, this was the most fascinating phase of the story to me. What did the mob do after Havana fell, after Castro came into Havana, which he did on January 8th? He finally arrived in the city. And so now the revolution has taken over. And the mob is caught in this in-between phase of trying to just see if they can salvage whatever they can salvage, or are they just going to have to lose everything and leave the island? And Lansky, and also one of his primary partner in the Havana mob was a mafiosi by the name of Santo Traficante Jr. from Tampa, Florida. These two men kind of were the controlling gambling impresarios on the island. And both of them maybe were in a denial to an extent. Traficante in particular believed that this was all just going to blow over and that Castro would be no different than all the other people who had run Cuba over many decades, that they would need the gambling money, that the money generated by the casinos and the nightclubs really was what was keeping the island afloat, and that they wouldn't be able to cut that off or the economy would collapse. And so the mobsters, Lansky and Traficante, placed a lot of faith in this belief and started a process of negotiating with the revolutionary government over the course of a few weeks and months on into the middle of 1959. And it just started to become apparent to them that this was something different, that Castro government was not just another government taking over in Cuba, that it was a true revolution, and that, the last straw was that the Revolutionary Guard wanted to have rebels in the counting rooms in the casino to monitor the money as it came into the casino, because they knew the gangsters were skimming money from the casino when it went directly into their bank accounts. And so the Castro government, if they were going to allow the casinos to operate, they were going to make sure that they got their piece of the pie. And that's when the mobsters saw that this was an untenable situation. There's no way we would be able to exist with this government. That was made emphatically clear in early 1961 when the Castro government finally took over ownership of all American businesses on the islands, not only the casinos, but the holdings of Shell Oil Company and the Hilton Hotel Company and all the major American corporations that had flourished and benefited from this mobster exploitation of Cuba throughout the 1950s.
You travel to Cuba to research this book.
Yes.
To what extent is this period of underworld domination, now decades ago, still a part of the Cuban popular or national consciousness?
Well, I think it's the Rosetta Stone. It's the most important thing to know to understand the revolution and why it happened, and also the relationship between Cuba and the United States that has existed since 1959, the animosity, the deep resentment and hatred. A lot of it has to do with the capitalist exploitation of Havana that took place in the 1950s, the belief that the gangsters, the organized crime figures, and the heads of the so-called legitimate American corporations and American politicians were all kind of in it together. And this has been used over the many decades by Castro and others within the revolution as a kind of a call to arms, a reason why we could never trust the United States government because of its criminal connections and criminal roots. And in modern day Havana today, you still see the remnants of this era through the casinos are all gone, but many of the hotels are still there. The Nacional, the Hotel Riviera, which was Lansky's baby, and a few others. And this era in general still exists in Havana. Havana kind of froze in 1959. So anyone who's been there knows this kind of surreal atmosphere of American cars from the 1940s and 50s, the architecture, which really hasn't changed much. It's all still there. It's crumbling and broken down, but it's still very much a visible presence in Havana when you were there. So in terms of research, it was very easy to recapture the spirit and atmosphere of this time just by walking the streets of Havana.
Well, T.J. English, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
T.J. English recorded last year. His book, Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba, Then Lost It to the Revolution, comes out in paperback next week. While Perez Prado was playing in the mob-owned hotels in Havana, Louis Prima was tearing it up in Vegas, often backed up by tenor saxophonist Sam Butera. Butera died on Wednesday in Las Vegas. He was 81. Here's Prima and Butera, recorded live in the painted desert room of the Wilbur Clark's Desert Inn Hotel.
Nobody move. I don't know where I'm going. It happened in Monterey a long time ago. It happened in Monterey in old Mexico, when there was thousands filled with thousands, luscious lips as red as wine. Stole somebody's heart, I'm afraid that it was mine. It happened in Monterey without thinking twice. You kissed me, gave me the key to paradise. Oh, my indiscreet heart, and you're the sweetheart that I left in old Monterey.
Coming up, the director of the indie film Wendy and Lucy, which made a lot of critics' top 10 lists last year. This is Fresh Air. The independent film Wendy and Lucy, which won critical praise and the Best Picture Award from the Toronto Film Critics Association, is now out on DVD. It was directed and co-written by my guest, Kelly Reichert. The film centers on misfortunes that befall a woman traveling with her dog to find work in Alaska. Wendy is played by Michelle Williams, who earned an Oscar nomination for her role in Brokeback Mountain. Her dog Lucy is Reichert's own endearing mutt. Kelly Reichert teaches film and electronic arts at Bard College and has directed 6 previous films, including River of Grass and Old Joy. In this scene from Wendy and Lucy, Wendy talks with a supermarket security guard, played by Wally Dalton.
How late are you here tonight?
8 o'clock. 8 to 8.
Okay.
Better than my last job, I'll tell you that. That was all night, every night.
Not a lot of jobs around here, huh?
I'll say. I don't know what the people do all day. Used to be a mill, but it's been closed a long time now. Don't know what they do.
You can't get a job without an address anyway. Or a phone.
You can't get an address without an address. You can't get a job without a job. It's all fixed.
That's why I'm going to Alaska. I hear they need people.
I hear it's real pretty up there.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly Reichert, welcome to Fresh Air. In this film, Wendy and Lucy, we follow this woman, Wendy, played by Michelle Williams, who is traveling alone, well, with her dog, Lucy, and runs into a rough patch. She's headed to Alaska, and the car breaks down in a town in Oregon. You know, the interesting thing about the film is that we don't learn very much about Wendy's life and history, how she came to be in this predicament. And I wondered, in order to direct Michelle Williams in the role, did there need to be a backstory in your head? I mean, did you have a fuller biography of Wendy that you shared with Michelle Williams?
She did want a fuller biography. And the screenplay came from a short story by John Raymond. And the short story was called Train Choir. And the Train Choir had a bit more background in it also. And so we used that, and we sort of filled in the blanks ourselves, Michelle and I, so that she would have something to work with. But the idea in the film for me was that I wanted the audience to experience her like a stranger, the way the people she comes across in the film experience her. So that you, you know, you sort of have to make this judgment call without having a lot of facts about her. You know, is she worthy of your sympathy just based on what you know or what you don't know?
Right.
Sort of, I guess, in the way that, you know, if you live in New York City, the way you maybe experience someone on a subway train asking for help or something like that, where, you know, you check them out and you make quick decisions based on really superficial things. What kind of sneakers are you wearing? Are you really in need? Are you in need enough? Whatever your thought process is in that moment.
She's also making judgments at every moment herself because she's on her own and has to decide how much she can trust people.
Yes, and she makes some bad decisions, as people do. You know, that I guess the whole story sort of came about in just post-Katrina, and where there seemed to be more than ever this sentiment of, you know, if people shouldn't let their lives get quite so precarious, and, you know, they wouldn't find themselves in this situation. And so as the sort of gap between the rich and the poor was becoming wider in the, you know, during the Bush years, I think, you know, John Raymond and I were just asking ourselves when we were coming up with an idea for the story, just, is it really possible to pull yourself up from your bootstraps in America if you don't have the benefit of health insurance, education, a financial net, a family net? Can you just, is all you need is the gumption and an idea to get out and do something differently to better your circumstances? Is that really enough? And so that sort of was the nugget that we started with.
There's a scene early in the film where Wendy meets up around a campfire with a group of people that are just traveling, living on the margin. Gutter punks, I think, was the phrase you used.
That is the phrase. They're kids who, there's quite a huge network of young people living off the grid. And these kids, they're homeless, and they travel all over the country, and they travel by trains. And they, it's dangerous post 9/11 to be hopping trains, but they do it. And I think Portland, where we were, is a place where maybe you, there is a community there, and you maybe stop there for a while and, you know, lick your wounds before setting back out. But we had a local casting man in Portland named Simon Max Hill, who really just made the scene with these kids and brought them in so I could meet them. And, you know, it's forever evolving and changing because they're in motion and they don't stick around for long. So he actually had a few kids living at his house near the inn just to keep them in town.
Well, just to be clear, these were not actors, in other words.
No, they're not actors. They're just kids living in various places and traveling around on trains, mostly outdoor places where they're living. But there were a few experiences that really gave me a lot of character information, not even just location information.
Experiences that you had while you were scouting?
While I was on the road, mm-hmm. one experience that was really particularly stands out is driving in Texas on Route 10. I was driving behind a van that had a blowout and went into the ditch in front of me. And I pulled over to see, it was a woman, and she was in her mid-40s, and she was in her socks, no shoes. She was a Mexican woman, and I asked her if she had, you know, AAA, and she said no. And I asked her if she had a spare tire, and she said that tire was my spare tire, the one that just blew out. And she said, before I bought this Pepsi, I had $20. And so I ended up spending the day with this woman, driving her to try to find a mechanic, which we were in the middle of nowhere. And then, you know, getting a a jack from a trucker and driving all the way back around to where our cars were, and really experiencing, I think, a lot of what the security guard in the movie experiences, just questioning, you know, how deep do I want to get into this? How can I get out of it if I want to? What's my obligation to her? What's the right amount to give? All these sort of questions. And also the woman herself just made such a huge impression on me. She was completely obviously used to things going wrong. She at no point got panicked over her situation. She really seemed to just look at it like, I'll go as far with her as I can, and I'll, you know, almost like she was looking at a to-do list of exactly what was in front of her, but not the big picture of her situation. And it was, you know, I was guessing that it was a management kind of thing that she was doing. And I really did apply that to Wendy.
There's also this interesting phenomena of, you know, Michelle Williams, who then was, you know, one of a pretty recognizable Hollywood star, I assume traveling around pretty anonymously with this small film shooting crew. And, you know, this is, of course, this was made before Heath Ledger died, right? But she had been in this relationship with him, and that had gotten her all kinds of publicity and attention, probably a lot of it unwelcome. I wonder what the experience was like for her to sort of play this anonymous character.
She has always said that one thing that attracted her to the character is that she felt Wendy really feels invisible in the world, and she really wondered what that would be like. And so, you know, when she came to Portland, because we don't have, you know, we're just so small, we're a group of cars on the side of the road, we don't have trailers and tents and all that sort of apparatus. I never saw Michelle get recognized while we were there. And I think it had to do with, you know, she would just be sitting on the curb, not looking like a movie star. And I really do think that she got to have that experience.
Film director Kelly Reichert. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Kelly Reichert. Her film Wendy and Lucy is now out on DVD. We should talk a little bit about Old Joy, your film you made in 2006. This is two guys in their 30s. Mark, who's played by Daniel London, is married and about to be a father, and he gets a call from his old friend Kurt, played by Will Oldham, the singer-songwriter, who's sort of more, I guess, more of a counterculture free spirit, and he invites his old buddy to get together and go visit a hot springs. I thought maybe we'd listen to just a bit of dialogue from this film.
Sure.
This is a scene where they're just heading out of town. They're not in the country yet. And let's give a listen.
Man, Mark, you really hold on to s***. Not that I should talk. I've still got crates of records in the garage at Ankeny Street, stuff I haven't even listened to in 10 years. I'm gonna have to take the whole load down to Sid's, I think, and see what I can get for it.
Sid's is gone, man.
No way.
The rent got to be too heavy. Now it's a smoothie place. Rejuvenation.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Sid sells on eBay now.
Oh, that makes sense. I should be doing that.
Tanya went by on the last day, said the only records left in the bins were our friends.
No more sins. End of an era.
And that's from the film Old Joy, directed by my guest Kelly Reichert. Couple of guys confronting change in their lives here, right?
I know Will's doing that whole scene without exhaling a bunch of pot smoke.
Right, right. He keeps lighting the little pot in his hands. Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of things going here, and it kind of reminded me of being in my 30s and getting together with people I had known in college and just after college, and discovered that we kind of wanted to be the same bunch of guys with each other, but couldn't quite.
Right. And I think that film, that's really what the film's about. And I think it's also, for us, it was about, I think, the loss of liberalism in America on some level. John Raymond had written that story before we even thought about making a film. It had come out in a book of photographs by Justine Kurland. And then when we were turning it into a script, in the original story, Mark wasn't married. Their lives were a little bit closer together. And I ended up making Mark a married guy and on the brink of fatherhood. But it was, we were making that film right before the reelection of Bush, and I guess had made the film by the time he did get reelected. And there really was this overwhelming feeling of, like, where do people like Kurt go? You know, are they allowed to, is there room for them in the country anymore?
Kurt's the guy who sort of has hung on to a counterculture lifestyle, sort of. Yeah,
right. He's a roamer, and he doesn't really fit easily in to, you know, buying a house, raising a family, and, you know, following that path. And so, I don't know. I guess with both films, I think that they're really small stories about, you know, in the case of Old Joy, about friendship and how time changes that, and how being a person that's sort of unhinged to anything in your 20s has a sort of romance to it, and what a fine line it is that, you know, you get to a certain age and that person is just, you know, a mess. Suddenly
right,
their
right.
lifestyle makes them, you know, that line of when you're a partier and then suddenly you're an alcoholic, you know,
right,
and
right.
that and that's sort of kind of what happens, seems to happen in your 30s, you know, where, you know, you even your, you know, freewheeling friends suddenly feel you should get with the program.
Right, right.
And, you know, and I had after making my first feature, River of Grass, I had lived around New York for 5 years without an apartment, just crashing at other people's houses, trying to get another film made, and, you know, living out of a duffel bag. And, you know, so I could relate to Kurt, and I could also say that Kurt, the Kurt character, you know, asks too much of his friends, and that his freedom becomes a big burden for everybody else.
Yeah.
And it was, that film was just a real joy of a project. It was a 6-person crew, and we really just went into the woods to make an art project, and, you know, 6 crew people, 2 actors and a dog. It was, it just felt like an experiment, and it was very, really gratifying and challenging.
I wanted to ask you one question about your background. I read you grew up in South Florida, and your dad was a crime scene investigator. Is that right?
Right. He was a crime scene detective, and my mother was a narcotics agent.
Do you think that you get, I mean, your films have, you have such an eye for visual detail. Do you think you picked anything up from your dad's sort of craft of looking for clues in a scene of the crime?
I do think so. I mean, I became really interested in photography in the summer of 5th grade, and my mom used to take us camping every summer. We'd go from like Miami to Montana, and I started taking my dad's camera with me. And all those crime scene photos were a big influence. Everything is, you know, it's super wide photography, and then you have the detail shots, which are, you know, the fingernail in the carpet sort of shots that are the side photos, the detail photos. But by and large, it's a really low to the ground, wide angle approach. And my first photographs were all like that.
Did you see your dad's crime scene photographs in the house or in a dark room?
Yes, in the house and in his office. When my when my parents got divorced, my father moved into a house with five detectives who had all gotten divorced at the same time. And we used to go to his office, and there were lots of crime scene photos about big and blown up, and they had notebooks of them.
That sounds like a movie to me, boy. this bunch of detectives.
That's the movie that never got made, but mm-hmm. It's all fine. Other people have made it much probably better than I could have. But my first film, River of Grass, my dad and his crime scene buddies actually, we built a crime scene room to imitate the office they had when I was a kid. And they worked with the production designer, Dave Dornberg, who was on that film. And those guys all came down and brought all these photos and recreated their own office for the movie, which was kind of a kick.
Wow. Well, Kelly Reichert, congratulations on the film, and we wish you more opportunities to do the kind of filmmaking you want to do. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly Reichert's film Wendy and Lucy is now out on DVD. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the estate of Richard Leroy Walters, whose life was enriched by NPR and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover public radio. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Satchel Paige was among the greatest pitchers ever and a show-stopping entertainer. But writer Larry Tye says his life is also an important part of the story of race in America. Long before baseball's color barrier fell, Tye says Paige used the shuffling stereotype and breathtaking talent to disarm racists and promote integration. His new book is called Satchel. Join us.